If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Schoenbrunn. I'm your host. Today, we have an incredible guest joining us today, Sari Singer. She became a dear friend of mine many, many years ago. She's got an incredible story that I'm going to let her tell you, but let me give you a little bit of her bio. Sari was born in Lakewood, New Jersey, and she's the daughter of a New Jersey State Senator, Robert Singer. Until 9/11, Sari worked a few blocks away from the World Trade Center. Deeply moved by the tragedy of 9/11, Sari decided to resign from her position in December of 2001 and move to Israel to help victims of terror. While there, Sari volunteered with various organizations working with victims of terror. On June 11th, 2003, Sari was on bus number 14 in Jerusalem when an 18-year-old Palestinian terrorist dressed as an unorthodox Jew boarded the bus and blew himself up. 17 people were killed, including all those seated and standing around Sari, and over 100 people were injured. Sari was hospitalized for 2 weeks and then returned to New Jersey to be with family. Her story became high profile. She appeared on television stations such as CBS, Fox News, CNN, and radio interviews. She spoke before congressmen and senators in Washington, D.C., and politicians in New York and New Jersey. In September 2003, she returned to work and volunteering in Israel. In June 2004, she returned to the United States to take care of ongoing medical issues associated with her attack. Sari is the founder and director of Strength to Strength, a charitable organization which focuses on bringing together victims of terrorism together from around the world and assisting with long-term psychological needs. Sari has addressed audiences throughout the United States, Canada, Europe, South America, and Israel, and continues to share her unique insight into the ongoing struggle for victims of terror in Israel and around the world. Please help me welcome Sari Singer.
Hi, Ari.
Hi, Sari. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, thank you for agreeing to come on the show. Now, as you know, the name of this podcast is Whispers and Bricks. The whispers are those voices telling you what is the right thing to do and represent the good things in life. The bricks represent the bad things that we go through in life. Now, whenever I speak, I always tell my audiences that I had the brick thrown at me on 9/11. That is something that you and I share. We've both had the brick thrown at us. What I find amazing is that we both decided on similar paths after the brick. We both started listening to the whispers and telling our stories to give hope to the world, even before we met each other. Now, my audience knows my story. Now we want to hear your story. So tell me, let's start with this. Prior to you moving to Israel in December of 2001, what were you doing?
I was working in downtown Manhattan for a nonprofit organization, working with young people, helping them to spend the summers abroad on summer programs in Israel. And I loved what I did. It was great. But when 9/11 hit and I wasn't in the office that morning because I overslept, that day changed for me in many, many ways. And I felt like the only thing I could do was to do something. And so I picked up and quit my job. And I led a birthright trip to Israel and decided I wanted to stay there and decided I wanted to volunteer with organizations that were working with victims of terrorism.
Wow. Wow. So early on, even before we get to the brick that was thrown at you, you were listening to the whispers. You saw 9/11. You survived by not being there, even though you could have been. And you listened to those whispers and decided to do something about it. And that's why you picked yourself up and moved to Israel. That's incredible. That's great. So tell us a little bit about what was going on in Israel. What were the events that led up to you being on that bus in Jerusalem when that homicide bomber, I call him a homicide bomber because they're not suicide, they're homicide. When the homicide bomber blew himself up, what was going on in your life at that point?
I mean, that day actually was a beautiful day. It had been the last day of classes because at that point I was working in a school. It was a year and a half after I had moved to Israel. So I'd been working in a school there, a post-high school program with about 50 post-high school students. And they had just finished their classes and were returning to the States that evening and in the coming days. And I was actually returning to the States the week after to work over the summer. and then come back to Israel. So I was also trying to clear things up and get in all my meetings. So that morning, I had a bunch of meetings all over Jerusalem. And if you ever know what New York City traffic is like, that's probably a little glimpse of what traffic is like in Jerusalem. And I didn't want to figure out how to take the different bus routes to get from meeting to meeting. So that day, even though I rarely took cabs, I decided that I was going to take cabs to all my meetings. And so I started off my morning. It was gorgeous. A lot of that day reminded me of the weather outside on 9/11, blue skies, perfect weather. And I just went from meeting to meeting in different parts of the city until my last meeting of the day, which was at 2 p.m., the person I was meeting with, who had known me for many, many years, had said to me, "What are you doing now?" And I said, "I'm going to go into the office," because the office is right next to where my meeting was. And he said, "But you usually only work till 2 p.m. And I said, "I know, but I want to get work done before I go back next week." So he's like, "I don't think you should go in. It's a gorgeous day." But I ended up going in. And that kind of led to the events that happened later on that day.
Wow. Wow. So, you know, bring us back to that moment. All right. Bring us back to that period in time. What were you thinking when you got on the bus? What were your feelings? I mean, our audience wants to know. You were the victim of a horrific event. All right. Tell us about it.
Sure. I mean, speaking to somebody who's also been through a horrific event, I know that you understand better than most people. But I think that in the time before, I wasn't thinking anything but what a beautiful day it was and how much I accomplished during that day. I remember that I was meeting a friend for dinner that evening at a place called Cafe Hillel, which is about, at that time, it was probably about a 5-minute walk from my apartment, maybe 7-minute walk. And I usually walk there, but because I was at my office, I didn't know what bus I needed to take to get there. So I called my friend and I said to her, "What bus can I take to get to the restaurant?" And she said, "Well, you can catch the number 14 bus. You can catch it right after Central Bus Station and it'll take you right into the street where we were having dinner." And so I think I started packing up at work at around 4 o'clock. And I took the first bus that I needed to get me to the Central Bus Station, because I was in an area of Jerusalem that was very Anglo, so lots of Americans, but it was a good, you know, 15-minute bus ride to get to the Central Bus Station. And then I went looking for the bus stop for the number 14 because I couldn't find it. Finally, when people gave me directions and I found it, it was definitely rush hour, probably close to at least 5 o'clock. I think I arrived at the bus stop around 5 o'clock and it was packed and the bus was running late and we were waiting around. And, you know, I started to feed into that antsiness that people were getting at the bus stop. And I said, "You know what, even though I have no money on me, I'm going to hail a cab and I'll stop at an ATM right at the entrance where we were going to have dinner." So as I went to hail the cab, I saw the 14 bus coming and I figured, okay, this must mean I'm meant to get on the bus because I had my bus pass. And I really didn't want to go and take out money from the ATM. And again, it was a lot of people at the bus stop at that point. When I finally got on the bus, I was on the phone with my friend at the time telling her I was probably going to be a few minutes late because of the traffic and everything. And once I did get on the bus, there were no empty seats. And I was exhausted. And even though I rarely sat down on the bus because usually older people were getting on or someone pregnant, I really wished there was an empty seat, but there wasn't. And as we made our way to the next bus stop, which was at the marketplace, I saw two seats open up right as we got to the bus stop. The two seats right in front of me, which were the last two seats in the front section on the right side. Now, normally I would have sat down on the aisle seat because somebody getting on from the marketplace would be coming with heavy packages. And I would have wanted to make space for somebody who was older. But for some reason, I don't know why, that day, I actually moved into the window seat. And I remember the girl who sat down next to me and her boyfriend who was standing. And I know that 200% that if I didn't take that window seat, I wouldn't be here today.
Wow. So in reality, you never should have been on that bus in the first place. This was something that you didn't normally do. You normally went from your apartment, right? You took cabs. So there was just like, and you actually were looking to take another cab before the bus even came. Now, all of a sudden, the bus comes out of nowhere, finally, and you say to yourself, "Okay, great. You know, I have my bus pass. So, you know, let me just go and let me just get on the bus." So, wow. So you were meant to be on that bus.
Correct.
It is obvious that you were meant to be on that bus. And obviously you did suffer the tragedy. Take us further on the rest of that.
I didn't think anything twice, even though at that point in 2003, there were terrorist attacks between 2002 and 2003 happening on a regular basis, especially in Jerusalem. But there was a ceasefire going on. So the last thing that I expected was that something was going to happen on a bus. And I was usually pretty careful. You know, when you move to Israel and you start living there, and, you know, for me, the first 10 months, I felt felt like I was on vacation. And then when I decided to stay, I really wanted to integrate and feel like I was living there. Your senses are heightened by certain things in the country, just like everyone else. You see a strange package, you're going to say something. It's automatic. So I always was looking around my surroundings. On this day specifically, I happened to have been more tired than usual. And I sat down and I remember I hung up with my friend from the phone and I looked outside for a second and there were hundreds of people waiting for different buses at the bus stop. It wasn't just one bus stop. So I saw tons of people. The marketplace was crowded as usual at the end of a day when people would go after work to pick up packages. And I didn't think twice about anything. And as we were starting to move, you know, back then in 2003, the cell phones were like these big phones and I didn't want to hold my phone. So I bent over slightly because again, the seats were very close to each other. I did bend over and I opened my knapsack and I dropped my cell phone into my bag. And as I went to zipper it up, I felt this huge shockwave hit me. And I didn't think it was a terrorist attack. I thought that maybe we got into a bus accident or that somebody hit me in the face with something. But the last thing that I thought was that somebody boarded that bus strapped with explosives to hurt and murder innocent people. And when the blast hit, the only way to explain what the shockwave feels like, it's like two pieces of metal that hit so hard against each other and vibrate back. That's what I remember my body feeling like. And I remember trying to lift my hands up to my face and the shockwave was pulling my hands down and my body was being pulled back against the seat from that shockwave. And when the blast stopped, there was a split second of silence. And I always say that it's not the silence that you hear outside when the crickets are out in the summertime. It's literally the silence of death all around you. It's a split second, but it feels like so much longer. And then after that split second, my ears started ringing really loud and I started screaming. And luckily I was screaming because somebody heard me.
Wow. Wow. So, I mean, because you bent over, because you bent down to put that thing away, that very possibly could have saved your life. Then the motion
very much that, so that, yeah.
That's what saved your life. They just, I have the chills. I literally have the chills. So the bus blew up. All right. People were killed. There must have been yelling and screaming. Were you like under somebody or were you, in other words, were people able to see you or were you like buried under bodies or, okay. You know, not to be so graphic, but
right. I'm not going to go so graphic with everything, but I was very lucky. There are two things. The doctor said that because I was looking down into my bag, that instinctively my eyes shut from the shockwave. So that saved my sight probably. So when the blast stopped, I couldn't open my left eye at all because something hit it and it was already swollen shut. And the right eye, I could barely open just enough to see the roof of the bus had fallen in and the man's head in front of me and he wasn't moving. But that was really all I saw. The thing that really saved me throughout this was the screaming because somebody was outside. He heard me screaming and he ran towards the burning bus. And I found out that this guy was about three blocks away. He heard the blast and he came running. He didn't know what it was, but he came running. And I always say, it always reminds me of the pictures that I saw on television on 9/11, when I saw people running from the towers, because here we're taught in the United States that when there's an emergency or something's happening, that we as civilians need to go to safety and we need to let the first responders take care of the problem. But in Israel, it doesn't matter if you're the police or the fire department, everybody comes running to help. This guy didn't know what it was. He heard the blast and he came running towards a burning bus. And he came to the bus and he said to me, "You have to get out." And I said, "I can't." And he told me that I need to put my foot up on the bar, which I thought was the window of the bus, but really it was the bottom of the bus that had blown out from the impact of the blast. And he and another man pulled me through this small hole and brought me to the side of the road where, again, this old woman who wasn't the police, didn't work for the hospital, was waiting with me, keeping me awake, asking me questions as if she was a mother waiting for her child to get help. And I thought, she's not the police. She doesn't know me, but she's here waiting with me as if she were my own family member. Because in Israel, it doesn't matter what's happening. Everybody comes running to help because you're a human being in need. And I think this is really the essence of the people there that sometimes gets lost in some of the, you know, media, you know, stuff that goes on. But really, everybody's coming to help no matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're a Jewish person or not. Everybody's coming to help because you're a human being that needs something. And that, to me, I was so grateful for.
So basically, I guess in Israel, everybody's a first responder.
Correct.
That's what it sounds like to me. Correct. Wow. 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 I'm shivering. Let me ask you this. I mean, you said that you ultimately went back to the States, right? Right after the bombing.
So after the bombing, just to input just one thing. So I was one of the first taken to the hospital because they knew I was awake. Right. A lot of people were unconscious from the blast. And so there was a small fire that broke out in the front of the bus. And they said it was lucky I was screaming because they were able to get me out. But on that day, over 100 of us were injured on and off the bus because that shockwave does impact people on the street. Right. And 17 innocent people were murdered, including everyone that was seated and standing around me. And only about 3 days later was I able to have the nurse turn on my television, and I saw the faces of the people that I remembered at the bus stop with me. The girl who sat down next to me and her boyfriend, I saw in the news that they had just gotten engaged. They didn't survive. The two rows in front of me, people didn't survive. And I really believe that the reason why I'm here and why God spared me and gave me a second chance was probably part of some of the work that I'm doing today, because there's no rhyme or reason why I'm here and they're not. And I can only put that up to that, you know, my time wasn't up and God had a bigger plan for me. And I take that with me every single day.
I hear, and I know the feeling. I know the feeling. Did you ever seek like counseling or anything after the bombing?
Sure.
You did.
Absolutely.
You did.
Absolutely. I felt like that. I always say this, and this is something that I think people need to keep in mind. Whenever anyone goes through a terrorist attack, but even more so anyone going through any type of trauma, I didn't have control over what happened to me that day, but I do have control over how I live my life going forward. And I want to make sure I live that life showing love and kindness and doing things that are making a difference in the world. And if I'm not healthy and I don't take care of the things that impacted me from that day, how can I ever be able to give to other people in the way that they need? So if I'm healthy, then I'm able to do more for others. So I was very big on that in the beginning.
I hear. But let me ask you this. I mean, what gave you the strength? You mentioned that you went back to Israel in September of 2003. Like, what gave you the strength to do that? Weren't you afraid? And what was like your parents' reaction to that?
Well, my father was very big on saying that, you know, how can a Jewish parent tell their child they can't go to Israel? It's just, he said, did he want me going back? Probably not. Did my mom want me going back? Definitely not. But I felt very strongly that if I didn't go back, what message was I sending that the terrorists win? Because terrorism wants to instill fear and it wants to paralyze us. And if I didn't go back to Israel, then the terrorists would have succeeded and set out for what they accomplished, was to make me afraid to be in a place that I love and not be able to live there and feel comfortable. Now, was I scared? Absolutely. I think that anytime you go through a trauma, you're going to have some sort of fear. But I also feel, and everybody has their own pace, there isn't a one size fits all, but everyone gets back to whatever type of normal that their life is going to turn into after something like this at their own pace. So for me, it was little steps. You know, I went back to Israel, but I didn't take public transportation. I actually didn't get back on a bus in Israel until the 9-year anniversary of my attack. And that a lot of people don't know unless they saw a friend of mine who wrote an article about it because he was with me. But on my 9-year anniversary, on the last day that I was in Israel, I was there with my mom. And I was visiting Hadassah Hospital, which is what I do every trip. I go back and visit the doctors and the nurses and the staff that took care of me to thank them for what they did in saving my life. Wow. And basically, I was with one of the staff of the hospital who was a very big part of my life the year after. Because the year after the attack, when I came back to Israel, the one thing that I said I would do was I wanted to give back to the hospital. And so about every week, I would speak to any groups or any journalists that were coming to the hospital, any English speakers. So every week I was at the hospital with these groups, and the director of communications who, you know, did all this stuff would ask me, could you speak here? Would this work with your schedule? So that last day on my ninth anniversary trip, he said to me, so where are you going now? I said, well, I leave tonight. And he said, well, have you gotten back on a bus this trip yet? Because he knew I hadn't been back on a bus all this. And I said, no. He said, what are you waiting for? It's been 9 years. You need to get back on a bus. And so I jokingly said to him, well, if you come with me, I'll get back on the bus. And he said, okay. And I said, really? And he said, yes. And so at around 5:00 in the evening, which is about the same time when I boarded the bus in that area, Jerusalem looks a little different than at the time of my attack. There's now a light rail that goes through that street. So we decided to take the bus route that would have taken me after the light rail into the German colony where I was having dinner. So we waited for the bus. And with that, me that day was my friend Shelley, who also survived a terrorist attack in Israel. She survived the Cafe Moment terrorist attack in Jerusalem. My mom, Ron Cromer from Hadassah in Kerem, who is the director there helping me. And my friend, Gil Hoffman, who is one of the editors at the Jerusalem Post. And wow. He came with his two kids. And I thought it was amazing. And we all got on the bus. And Ron was wonderful. He explained to the bus driver that this was my first time back on a bus in Israel since the attack. And the bus driver wouldn't take any money from us for that trip, which is just so Israel in that sense. And I get on the bus and Ron had brought and said to me, would you like us to document this with Avi, the photographer who I knew from that year speaking? And I said, sure, let Avi come. It'll be great. So Avi was taking pictures. It was very emotional and very difficult, I will say. And as we get on the bus, two young ladies who were sitting in the seat where I was in that first section said, what's going on? Who are you? Like, are you a celebrity or something? And I explained to them that I was in a terrorist attack 9 years ago that month, and that they were in the seats where I was seated with somebody who didn't survive, who I didn't know. And they said, you have to sit back in these seats. So I sat down at the window seat and my friend Shelly sat down next to me. We went two stops on the bus and then I told Ron that I really needed to get off. And I felt like as soon as I stepped off that bus at that second stop, I won. Because the second I boarded that bus, I beat the terrorists. Mm-hmm. Even if I never get back on a bus again, at least I know that I got on it and I was on that route of where I would have gone that day. And that to me is just, you know, a small win. But for, you know, those of us impacted by terrorism, those are big wins on so many different levels. And I've actually, since that time, I haven't taken public transportation on a bus in Israel, but I have taken the train between Haifa and Tel Aviv, which I thought was huge. And I did that by myself. Okay. Which was also a big thing. And I think it's small steps, but I'm not afraid to be there. I love being there. I feel safer there than I do in most places in the world. And it's like home when I'm there. So I definitely don't feel, and I feel like I was in the best hands I could have been when that happened. So wow. I feel very blessed.
Wow. That's such an incredible, incredible story. I mean, I think this is the first time I've actually heard the entire story. But let me ask you something. So you've been addressing audiences around the world. Were you always like a public speaker? I mean, is this something you aspired to? Has this become a passion of yours?
Yes, this is definitely... I don't think the public speaking is a passion. I mean, I definitely can speak and I definitely think that's in the genes. And I chalk up a lot of my strength and my ability to speak to my parents. Both of them are very strong people. I grew up with my father in politics. Since, you know, he's been there over 30 years. So I've watched him speak and he's definitely, you know, an amazing speaker and can handle just about anything. I think that a lot of that comes from them and those role models that I had growing up. But I think that this has become a passion, not of speaking, but of sharing my story, which represents thousands of people in Israel and even more around the world that have been directly impacted by terrorism. And so it's not just my story, it's their story too. And a lot of victims, you know, both survivors and bereaved family members can't always talk about what they've been through. So if I can share something that's going to make another person understand and it's going to help somebody not to go towards the direction of carrying out an attack and maybe stop them and having them think about what they're doing and how they're impacting lives, I think that's the mission and that's the passion for me, to be a voice for victims, to make sure I'm a voice for those 17 innocent people that didn't get to go home to their families that day. And I keep that in mind that I was and that I'm able to do this. And if my voice can be their voice, then that to me is so important.
So tell a little bit about Sister Strength. I know you started this organization. They work with victims of terror. Tell us a little bit about it. We don't have a lot of time. So, sure. You know.
Well, we're lucky enough to have you as one of our board members, longtime board members. And I feel very blessed to have an incredible board, both of survivors and bereaved family members and actual professionals, business people who just care about victims of terrorism who may not have been directly impacted. Our organization is survivor driven. We are an all volunteer organization. And basically, when I came back to the US, I really had nowhere to connect. I came back and I wasn't a 9/11 survivor, so I couldn't engage in any of the 9/11 activities. So, you know, when you don't find what you're looking for, you start it yourself. And so I decided that there was no organization that was connecting different victims from all over. So the idea behind it is that we work with existing organizations on the ground in about 15 different countries around the world, helping to bring victims, both survivors and bereaved family members together to help them survive and thrive. And the idea is is that we all know what we've been through. Who better to help another person that's been through something similar than those of us that have already been through the process? And we run weekend retreats. We run survivor circle meetings. We run survivor and bereaved victim exchanges. We do things on anniversaries in different parts of the world for different victims. We run a young ambassadors program with young people ages 15 to 20 who've been directly impacted. And then they build their own global peer support group. The idea is just to have a global community of support for anyone who's been impacted. And we've been very blessed to really connect with some amazing organizations. Most recently, in the last 2 years, we've added to our organization's Brussels, an organization in Belgium, working with victims from the Brussels attacks, a new organization in Iraq for victims there, which I was so happy to see. And we're unfortunately growing because terrorism is not, the impact happens in a second for many victims, but what we go through lasts a lifetime. And some people can run away from it and some people don't want to deal with it, but I definitely believe in dealing with it head on. And what I believe is the most important thing is not that, you know, you might have long-term PTSD or different psychological and physical problems, but the idea is that you have a community of people that are really incredible that become like family. And I always say that in the worst thing that's ever happened in my life, the most amazing thing is that I've met all these people from all over the world, from all these different countries that we would have never, ever interacted with each other, but we've all experienced something that bonds us for life. And they're like my family. And I know that if I am anywhere in the world, whether it be stuck somewhere in Europe or somewhere in South America, that I'm able to reach out and call somebody there. And I have somebody that can take care of me or that can help me with something. And that to me is tremendous. And so through the worst thing, it's really these connections that we have with these people to show that terrorism is not just one country's problem, it's a world problem. And we all need to come together to combat that hate. And I think that's what Strength to Strength really stands for. The idea that we are showing the terrorists that you may have done something to hurt us, but we are going to move forward together and become stronger because we have each other. And that's really what the organization's doing. And even through COVID, we've been running weekly Zoom meetings. We just ran yesterday our first virtual one-day retreat with both bereaved and survivors. And it was just incredible to see. It was our pilot test. This group has actually been together for a number of retreats. And we hope to be able to offer it ongoing now going forward through COVID until we can resume our in-person activities.
Wow. Sounds amazing. So if people want to volunteer in this worthy cause or they want to donate to the charity, what would be the best way to do that? How would they go about it?
They can visit our website at stosglobal.org. They can reach out to me and email me at Sarri, S-A-R-R-I, at stosglobal.org. They can reach out to the 877 number on the website and call us and tell us that they're interested in volunteering. They can make a donation on the website. We are redoing our website right now, so that'll be coming out in the next month or so, we hope. So we have a lot of good things, changes happening in the organization, a lot of different programming coming up in the next few months. And we want people to know that even if you haven't been directly impacted by terrorism, you can support others who have. And for a victim of terrorism, and I use that term because survivors and bereaved family members, we're both victimized by terrorism. That's what's happened to us. But I always say we are all survivors and how we're moving forward together. And the best thing for someone that's been through a situation like us to know is that somebody that lives either close by or far away cares enough to help us because they haven't been through what we've been through. And that if God forbid they ever were to go through what we've been through, there's a place they can come to. And there's a place of support and love and care and security and an idea, knowing that there's a safe place for them to be.
Wow. That's just incredible. So let's give us that website address again, please.
Sure. It's stosglobal.org.
Okay, great. And it's Sarri, S-A-R-R-I, at stsglobal.com.
S-T-O-S.
Yes.
Global.org.
.org. Okay, great. Okay, this has been amazing. This, for me, I'm sure my listeners are sitting on the edges of their seats. Just one last thing. Is there anything you'd want to share with the audience before we go? Words of advice, words of wisdom? I think you pretty much wrapped it up.
I mean, the only thing I think I'd want to share is that, you know, during the last year of the world going through COVID, I think that people understand more than ever psychologically how things can really be difficult. And I think it's something that we all share in common right now. And I just think that we all need to be kinder to each other. We need to be more understanding. We need to realize that we don't always know what the other person is going through. And while everyone might look good on the outside, that doesn't mean that that's how they're doing on the inside. And I think just check in with people, make sure they're okay. A smile, a phone call, even a text message really goes such a long way in this time where we're so disconnected from each other in person. And I just think also, as being kind to other people, we need to be kind to ourselves. We need to make sure we take care of ourselves more. And I think that's something I've learned through this pandemic is that, you know, we really need to focus on ourselves a little bit more in order to be able to focus and be able to outwardly do more for others. So that's what I would leave people with.
Wow. Sari, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. I'm sure you've touched the heart of my audience. Good luck going forward. Keep up the good work. All right.
Sorry.
We're all proud of you. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks. I'm your host, Ari Schoenbrunn. Until next time, listen to the whispers and never, ever give up in your dreams. Bye for now.
So that's it for today's episode of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.